Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
After months of being courted by candidates and stalked by journalists, Iowans are set to caucus tonight. Whether their choices for party nominees will predict the outcome of primaries nationwide remains to be seen. But Iowa voters, and voters elsewhere, everywhere in fact, will be making choices for 2016 with brains that have not changed much over the last 10,000 years. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest says our evolutionary wiring can keep us from fully engaging with challenging issues, prevent us from accurately assessing the intentions and capabilities of office seekers, even interfere with our empathy for people whose suffering might be relieved by public policy. But he's convinced it doesn't have to. Rick Schenkman is publisher and editor of the History News Network and author of the new book Political Animals: How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Rick, welcome to Think.
I am delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
So as much as we feel different from other animals, we are animals just the same. To what extent do we function based on instinct despite these very powerful brains that we have?
Well, here's the problem we have. Our brain was basically designed to help address the problems that hunter-gatherers faced during the 2.5 million-year-long period that's known as the Stone Age, not to address the problems that we human beings face in the modern age in the 21st century. And it's a real disconnect. There's a mismatch. In our personal lives, often we can go with our instincts. But in politics, which involves the fate of millions of people, well, we have a problem because our brain wasn't designed to deal with millions of people, but to deal with small groups of people in our immediate surrounding.
And to be clear, the fact that traits have evolved and lasted into the modern era does not necessarily mean they serve us optimally, just that they haven't, you know, caused us all to go extinct.
Exactly.
So it's not that we're stupid, and you make this point in the book. Do we act in stupid ways, or what's the problem here?
Our politics are stupid. 8 years ago, I wrote a book called Just How Stupid Are We Facing the Truth About the American Voter? And that's what got me on this road of trying to explore the science behind this. So you've got all kinds of horrible statistics that indicate our politics are stupid. So only 1 in 5 Americans know that we have 100 U.S. senators. A majority of the American people don't know we have 3 branches of government. They can't name the 3 branches of government. On the eve of the Iraq War in 2003, in March of 2003, just as we're about to launch missiles at Iraq, a majority of the American people thought that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11 and that that was the main reason why we were going to war with Iraq, and that made sense to them because of that reason. Now, none of these things indicate that people are stupid and have a low IQ, despite the title of my old book. I was just trying to grab the attention of the American public and say, look, we have a real problem. Well, now Donald Trump has, I think, helped make my case for me. It's very obvious to most thinking people, I think, that we do have a problem. People are being manipulated by politicians like Trump who are playing on their basic instincts rather than to higher order cognitive thinking. And that's a real trouble in a modern 21st century democracy.
Rick, why do we find it so hard to change our thinking about people or about issues, even when new information would seem to demand a whole new way of processing that information? For example, there are people who still believe that President Obama is a foreign-born practitioner of Islam. They think he's Muslim.
Yeah, well, they think he's Muslim. They think he was born in Kenya. I mean, this is millions and millions of people, so this is not insignificant. It's a real problem. Basically, it comes down to this. Belief trumps facts. Back in 2004, neuroscientist and social scientist Drew Weston conducted a bunch of experiments where he put people inside an MRI machine, and he said, here are a bunch of hypocritical statements made by George W. Bush. What do you make of them? Well, the Bush supporters basically ignored the bad information, and you could see in from their brain activity that they literally were shutting off the flow of information into their brain so they didn't have to deal with it. And that put them into a state of ease. And when he had John Kerry voters inside the MRI machine and he asked them about hypocritical statements that John Kerry had made, the same result. As human beings, we don't want to be disturbed by what the social scientists refer to as dissonance. We hate dissonance. So our brain quickly tries to create a situation where it gets rid of the dissonance. And it does that not by changing our belief, but by getting rid of the facts. But I do want to point this out, and it's something that I emphasize in the book. Science is giving us new insights into how our brain works that also make me an optimist. And here's why. There's something called the theory of affective intelligence. And what this suggests is that anxiety, which is an emotion that all human beings are born with, unless you're a psychopath, we are born with this feeling of anxiety. And what that means is that when we get a significant disconnect between our personal strongly held beliefs and what the world is telling us is reality, at some point, the burden of hanging on to our belief becomes greater than the burden of entertaining the idea of changing our belief. And what triggers that feeling is anxiety. So as human beings, much as we don't want to know the truth, we don't want to face the truth, we want to kind of shut it down, at some point, our brain kicks in and says, hey, wait a minute, you actually better revisit this issue.
And yet we really, you know, want someone to blame when things aren't going well. And you have some remarkable case studies of times when things like natural disasters affected, you know, portions of the population. And when that happens, these are, you know, storms and shark attacks, things that have nothing to do with political leadership. People kick incumbents out of office.
Yeah, I opened the book with the story of the worst shark attacks in American history. They occurred 100 years ago off the coast of New Jersey, in southern New Jersey, in these little beach towns over there in the summer of 1916. And four people lost their lives over a two-week period in a series of fatal shark attacks. Well, the immediate impact on the community was that the hotels emptied out, restaurants started going bankrupt because, of course, all the tourists fled. Nobody wanted to go in the water anymore, right? So that's a case of our instincts working the way they were designed to work. That was a good thing. That made sense. 4 months later, Woodrow Wilson was on the ballot. He was running for re-election. Now, he had been the governor of New Jersey, the president of Princeton, so people locally knew him. And back 4 years earlier, when he first ran, he had won their support overwhelmingly, and he had won the support of New Jersey voters. What happens in the 1916 re-election? Well, in everywhere else in the state, he runs pretty much the same way that he ran 4 years earlier, and he's re-elected. But in the beach towns that had faced these horrible shark attacks with the resulting economic dislocation after the hotels emptied out, he lost decisively in the same percentages as Herbert Hoover would lose another generation later after the onset of the Great Depression. So were they blaming Woodrow Wilson for these shark attacks? Well, obviously, you couldn't hold Woodrow Wilson responsible for the shark attacks. But in human brains, there's a portion of it that says when you are experiencing bad times, you've got to hold somebody to blame. And they decided to hold the incumbent, Woodrow Wilson, to blame. And social scientists have all kinds of studies that show how this pattern shows up over and over and over again.
And that's a pattern, I suppose, that would make sense if you were in a sort of small group or a tribe with 50 people and there was one person in charge who was messing up things for the entire group. It doesn't seem to make so much sense when you're dealing with hundreds of millions of people.
Well, exactly. That is the point of the whole book. That's what I'm trying to say, is that there is this mismatch between our instincts and the situation which we find ourselves. So what I'm calling on people to do is every time they have an instinctive response in politics, they need to second-guess themselves and ask this question. Does the current context fit? Do our instincts, which are driving us to believe one thing rather than another thing, do those instincts match the circumstances in which we find ourselves? If they do, great. And sometimes they do. So, for instance, if you see a terrorist lopping off the head of some innocent victim, as a human being, you're watching this on TV and you have an instinctive reaction, that's appalling, that's horrible. That context works. You're having the right reaction. But you are not having the right reaction if the next thing you do instinctively is to say, we need to send jet bombers over there and start bombing people. That act of having bombers go over there, well, now that's a complicated question. That's a policy question that involves very hard-to-answer questions about what would be the effectiveness. Is there a great danger that we're going to kill a lot of innocent people? And whether or not this is actually going to work in the end, or are we going to wind up alienating more people than we are killing of the bad guys? So that's where you need to stop and say, whoa, I need to second guess myself. And that requires higher order cognitive thinking, which, of course, as Daniel Kahneman, the famous psychologist at Princeton, says, our brain is lazy. We don't like to do that kind of thing. We'd prefer to just go with our instinct.
Well, Rick, why are we more afraid of terrorist violence, which is horrific but rare, than of, say, being killed because the infrastructure in this country is not in great shape?
The social scientists have a wonderful phrase that I learned. You know, I'm a historian, so for me, the last 5 years that I was working on this book was a real adventure. It was an intellectual adventure in learning about the insights from social scientists, neuroscientists, evolutionary psychologists, political psychologists. I hadn't studied anything like this since I was in college 40 years ago, so this was a real a wonderful adventure. And here's one of the things I learned. The social scientists have a phrase called perceptual salience. And what that means is that we respond to what we perceive is important. Well, when we see pictures on television night after night of terrorists blowing up buildings and killing people, and we're literally watching them execute people, lopping off their heads, we can't help but have a strong reaction because it's affecting a lot of our senses. Certainly our visual sense is just completely engaged when we see some horrible act like this. And the problem with, like you say, what about infrastructure falling down? Well, occasionally we see a picture of or video of a bridge collapsing. But most of the time, we're not seeing that night after night after night. If we were, then it would become perceptually salient, and we would have a response, an instinctive response to it, like, wow, this is a real problem. We need to spend a lot of money. We need to fix this. But it's fleeting. But the terrorism stuff tends to be on the news all the time. And so it becomes something that's perceptually salient to us.
Rick Schenkman is my guest. He's publisher and editor of the History News Network and author of the new book, Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. This is Thank on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the publisher and editor of the History News Network, Rick Schenkman. He's got a new book out called Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Rick, given that most Americans will never be in the same room with any of the people they ever vote for, let alone spend enough time with them to really know them on a personal level, how is it that we formulate opinions about our politicians in the first place?
Well, this is some of the most scary research that I came across. We form an opinion about somebody within 167 milliseconds of meeting them. Now, this is faster than it takes to blink your eyes. Wow, think about that. Let that sink in for a minute. That's just crazy. And if you give people more time to make an evaluation, they just become more convinced that their initial impression was the right impression. So here's a study that was done. It involved a couple of hundred Harvard students, and they were asked to take a look at 10-second video clips of politicians who had run for office and won. And they were trying to, well, some of them had won and some of them hadn't. So they asked these kids, hey, who do you think you like the best? And they came up with nearly 60% of the winners. That suggests that what they're doing in looking at these 10-second video clips is an awful lot like what the voters must be doing, since they're coming so close to the same kind of conclusion as the voters. So even though we talk so much about policy and we think that we're rational, actually, a lot of the time we may just be making up our minds based on our instant reactions to somebody. And that is not a very clever way to run a democracy.
We have this sense that we can tell when somebody is lying to us and that we can tell when they're telling the truth. It would seem to be an evolutionary advantage to be able to detect lies, Rick, but I wonder if maybe it's a greater advantage to be able to get away with them.
Well, both happen. So we have both in our brain kind of a built-in McAfee system that is trying to protect us from people we come across who are lying to us. And we also have a built-in system of hackers trying to defeat other people's McAfee system. Because in some circumstances, it's really helpful to us and to our fitness, the survival of our genes, to be able to get away with a good lie. And in other cases, it's certainly better for our fitness if we can be really truthful. So we work both sides of the street here as human beings. And what it means is that when you are looking at politicians and you're trying to assess whether or not they're telling the truth, well, you've got your lie detector mechanism working at full blast. But they've also got their, we're going to try and manipulate you, systems working full blast. So you're both trying to work it out. Now, there are two things that help save us from being manipulated by lying politicians. So one is reputation. A person who lies repeatedly eventually in our society earns a reputation for lying. And that really helps. But of course, it can take years and decades. Look at Richard Nixon. Here's a guy who Democrats, of course, didn't like for years, but the American people kept reelecting him to high office, and they elected him president twice, and the second time in the greatest landslide in American history. So it takes an awful lot of time before we finally catch on, before a majority finally catches on. So that's one thing. The other thing is that when we are listening to somebody talk, we have our antenna up. We are trying to gain some idea about whether or not they are lying to us. So we see, are they twitching? Is their voice rising a little higher? Do they seem nervous? But here's the thing. Here's where the politician can get around our cheater detection system. All the politician has to do is believe what they're saying. They're like a used car salesman. If the used car salesman believes the pitch that he's making to you, well, it's a lot harder to detect where his lie is. So these politicians just convince themselves that they're telling the truth, and then they don't seem nervous. So our cheater detection systems go silent. We don't get a flare in our brain saying, hey, I think this guy is nervous. I think he's lying to me. Wow, that's really problematic.
The Nixon thing is personal for you.
Oh, so you're going to bring that up, are you?
You put it in your book, so absolutely I'm going to bring
it up. I did. I'm only joking with you. 40 years ago, I was a student in college, and I was wholly in the tank for Richard Nixon. I loved Richard Nixon. I thought the world of him. I was one of these millions of people who was taken in by him. He had gone to China and Russia. He seemed to be a peacemaker. It seemed like he had closed down the Vietnam War in about as good a way as possible, given the horrible circumstances of that war. And I thought he deserved re-election. And when the Watergate story started coming out, well, what did I do? I actually followed the Watergate story really closely. I knew the story inside out. I knew all the facts. And yet it didn't persuade me. Month after month after month, disclosure after disclosure after disclosure, the Saturday Night Massacre, all these horrible things were happening. And I just kept sticking by Richard Nixon. I stuck by him until 2 months before he finally resigned. And that was long after a majority of the American people had abandoned Richard Nixon. So what was going on there? What was going on inside my head? I was a smart guy. I was educated. I knew the facts. And yet I allowed myself to be completely bamboozled by this man's lies. Well, what was going on was belief was trumping facts. And my partisan brain was in overdrive, and I wasn't allowing the facts in. And that is what happens in politics. And that haunted me for years. And part of writing this book was a quest to kind of finally figure that out. And what I finally figured out was I just have to come to terms with the fact that while facts are important, and I love facts, facts are not decisive in the end. Belief is really, really important, except when the burden of hanging on to your belief becomes greater than the burden of switching your belief. And that's that discussion of anxiety that we had a little bit while ago.
Actually, I thought your candor about that story was great, and it really sort of drew in the reader. But it can work the other way, too, right? You can despise a candidate despite evidence that this person might be fit for office for whatever reason or might be a good choice. It's easy to hang on to the fact that you just really can't stand somebody.
Oh, yeah. I think that this is a big part of what's happened during the Barack Obama years. You have Republicans who took an instant dislike for him, in some cases perhaps because he was a black man in the White House and they were not ready for that kind of significant, important change. It just really didn't sit well with them. In other cases, just because he was pushing through the largest social reform since Lyndon Johnson in the Great Society days, the Obama health care reform was really huge, to borrow Trump's vocabulary. And people just had this dislike toward him. And it didn't matter what the facts were. They just basically seized on any fact, any evidence that seemed to reinforce their belief, which is something that social scientists refer to as confirmation bias. So once we have a conviction, we then just look for evidence, facts, stories, anything that we can find that bolsters our belief. And then there's the opposite, which is called disconfirmation bias. So any facts that came out that suggested that maybe Barack Obama had done a good job, well, we tend to disconfirm all those kinds of facts. So this makes us have a very partisan, prejudiced brain, and that is just part of what being human is.
And we also seem to want to put people in a box. You know, sometimes I have a 13-year-old daughter, and she'll come home and say, was this president good or bad? As if, like, you can definitively put them in one category or the other, when it would seem, you know, down the line, with very few exceptions, most of our presidents did good things, and they did some bad things or some regrettable things at the same time.
That's a great point. So the human brain is designed to come up with as many shortcuts as possible and still have us survive and thrive. So we are constantly trying to not think about things so that we can focus on genuine threats to our survival. Hmm. So if we can come up with a quick stereotype about a group of people or an individual president, we're going to go with that, because we don't have time to be thinking really hard about those people.
So, like, Nixon's in charge, I can relax now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Obama's a bad person, I reached that conclusion.
Yeah.
We don't like to revisit our thinking.
Yeah.
If you had to revisit your thoughts all the time, you couldn't get out of bed in the morning. So this is part of our human survival, is that it's dependent on us coming up with what the social scientists refer to as schemas, which is basically a way of understanding the world and our place in it. So we come up with a serviceable stereotype about the way the world works, about other people, about presidents, about groups. And until we are confronted with overwhelming evidence that that schema doesn't fit the facts, we stick with it so that we can focus on other things that are more important, more perceptually salient to us.
So we might be disappointed not only when our leaders fail to live up to certain moral and ethical standards or to effectively manage a challenging situation. We can also be disappointed when they just dare to be honest with us. What do our Stone Age brains have to do with the way we punish politicians who speak the truth that is unpleasant?
Well, this is another great point. So I tell the story in the book about Walter Mondale, who to this day thinks that when he told the American people the truth in 1984, when he was accepting the Democratic Party's nomination for president, he was running against Ronald Reagan, for your younger listeners who may never have heard of Walter Mondale. So he gets up there and he says, hey, Ronald Reagan's going to raise your taxes, and so am I. He'll deny it. I just told you I would. Well, Mondale thought he would get a lot of credit for being authentic and for being a truth teller. And in his memoirs, which he wrote a few years ago, he stands by that claim. Well, Walter Mondale is a wonderful person, but he's overwhelmingly too naive to be president of the United States. The American people don't want the truth. What we want is to have our beliefs confirmed. That's what human beings always want. We don't privilege the truth. We want our version of the truth to be privileged. And that's why we get taken in by myths all the time. Three of the books that I've written over the last few decades involve myths that Americans believe about our own history and the history of other people. Everything from the log cabin myth, to Betsy Ross and sewing the first flag, the Liberty Bell. These are all stories that we grow up with as kids. Historians have debunked all of these, and yet we still believe them in the culture. And why is that? Because we would rather continue believing a myth that makes us feel good about ourselves, makes us feel that we're an exceptional people, for instance. That's one of the classic myths, right? That America is an exceptional country in 100,000 ways and much better than all these other countries around the world. And we believe that. And, of course, that makes us feel good about ourselves. And we don't want to revisit that. We don't want to question it. Well, that's something that Walter Mondale apparently couldn't get. He couldn't get his head around that. He really thought that we privileged the truth. He bought into the children's myth that, just tell the truth and everything will be okay. We don't want to hear hard truths from our politicians. That's why Reagan won by telling us it's morning in America. I mean, that was a meaningless catchphrase, but it went over well because people wanted to believe it. Another part of this is that we're optimists at heart. 80% of us, according to social science research, are optimists. And what that means is that that's the largest constituency that's out there. So anytime a president tries to tell us hard truths that maybe will make us think darkly about the future, they're not going to get themselves elected. You've got to tell people what they want to hear. It's got to be an optimistic message.
Is there something different about politics and politicians, though? Because, for example, you know, if I go to the doctor and I've felt okay, but she says you have a disease that you need to take care of, or if I go to the bank and my banker says you're out of money, I don't typically blame them for that problem.
Well, that's a good point. And this is the problem that we have with politics, is politics in the modern world is not terribly personal. Hmm. It's conducted on an abstract level. So a politician who's trying to reach millions of people, he's not talking to a group of people who are right in front of him, who he has lived with and worked with for years and years and years, which was the case with our hunter-gatherer ancestors living in small communities of no more than 150 people. He is trying to persuade millions of people to vote for him and to support his causes. Well, that means he's got to try to use all kinds of tricks and strategies to get us to go along with him. And what I argue in the book, I have a whole chapter on this, is that when you are trying to lead these large groups, you are inevitably going to be pushed in the direction of manipulation, because these large groups don't really hang together all that well. Families, close-knit families, they hang together in a crisis. What do groups do? Let me just elaborate on that a bit. Even when the Tsarnaev brothers were cornered and one was killed and the other was captured, these were the two brothers who pulled off
the Boston
bomb exactly a few years ago. Their family stood behind them. When a group gets in trouble, what happens? Everybody starts fighting each other. That's what's going on in the GOP right now. The party just starts to collapse. And it's because large groups of millions of people don't hang together very well. So politicians trying to lead those groups have to really manipulate them through red, white, and blue, patriotic appeals, fear, anger.
Got to jump in here. My guest is Rick Shankman. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rick Shankman, who is publisher and editor of the History News Network, about his new book, Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Before we take some calls, Rick, I just want to talk about this. We are wired to empathize. We're even wired to behave altruistically in certain cases to people who are not members of our genetic line, right? People who are not direct family members. Is there something, though, about the scale of political issues that makes it harder for us to access that empathy?
Well, anytime we are asked to be empathetic about people who dress differently than we do, who talk differently than we do, speak a foreign language, who live in a place where we can't find it on the map, we are going to turn them into abstractions. And as soon as we turn them into abstractions, that means we can't really empathize with them. And that's a real problem in foreign policy, because it means that the American people in charge of the last remaining superpower on Earth are making decisions about people that they don't really have a human empathetic connection to. And that can just spell disaster.
All right, let's go to the phone now. We have Marcia on the line in Navarro County. Hi, Marcia.
Good morning. Is there any hope? I intend to read the book anyway, but I can't wait to ask. Does the author have instances when this burden of holding on to a belief or the belief trumps back? Are there cases where the voting public has changed an opinion based on facts?
Thanks so much for your call, Marcia. Go ahead.
Yes, the answer is absolutely, and it's when anxiety kicks in. So let's go back to the Watergate example that I spoke about earlier. The American people stuck by Nixon for 11 months after the Watergate burglary, and that's a sign of their partisan brains just refusing to face facts. But after the 11 months had elapsed, enough bad headlines had come out that they began to change their opinions. And by the 12th and 13th month after Watergate, in other words, a little bit more than a year, a majority moved away from support for Nixon. So that shows that facts, in the end, can actually matter. But it can take an awful long time. Here's the problem we've got with global warming. Scientists tell us that we need to be acting now, for instance, in changing our lifestyles so that we stop contributing to the phenomenon of global warming. Well, the problem is until the human brain sees these ice cliffs falling in significant amounts and see it on TV night after night after night, we're going to be a little slow to react to that problem. And the challenge is, well, if we wait until we have that natural human nervous reaction to a threat to our existence, scientists say it'll be too late. We need to be acting now. We can't wait for the water to lap up over the buildings in Miami. We need to act now. That's the pessimistic part. But the positive part is people do ultimately react to the facts.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Sarah on the line in North Dallas. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I'm glad to hear someone on the radio with some common sense. Your guest, that I'm really interested. I'm going to have to buy his book. But what's always perplexed me is I wonder why is it that people in middle class and lower income, the ones that vote Republican, why is it that they think that that party is going to help them when it's just the opposite? And I don't understand that. That's always been very perplexing to me.
Any thoughts, Rick?
Yes. Well, it's very perplexing to social scientists, and there is no agreed consensus to explain why people don't vote for their own self-interest. But here are a couple of things that observations I'd make. Number one, our self-interest is defined broadly for human beings. It's much more than just your economic self-interest. So if you're an evangelical voter in Iowa, for whom the most salient issue is abortion, you're going to vote for somebody who maybe isn't good for you economically, but they're in sync with you morally. And we are, at the end of the day, much more in tune with morality than we are self-interest. That's a little counterintuitive, but your moral perceptions well up from deep inside your brain, out of consciousness, and according to the social scientist Jonathan Haidt, whose work I think of very, very highly, those moral beliefs that we strongly hold, they're not usually subject to a lot of rational debate. We just believe what we believe. So if you believe abortion is bad, it's probably coming up from your unconscious. And then what you're doing when you debate it, you're just coming up with a lot of reasons to justify this existing belief that you already had. So when a politician makes a claim on your moral beliefs and he's in sync with your moral beliefs, well, he's much more likely to get your vote than if he is in sync with your economic situation and, you know, vote for him and he's going to put more money in your pocket. That can work, It obviously worked for FDR during the Great Depression and for Democrats for decades. But then Republicans figured out how to use moral beliefs against Democratic politicians, and they started winning election after election.
One of the things that causes you to be optimistic about our ability as a society to do things the right way or to amend the way we've been approaching politics is that culture has a great impact on our behavior. And one example that you give is that, by and large, people today are actually far less violent than they were thousands of years ago.
Well, just think about 100 years ago in Waco, Texas. I'm speaking to a Texas audience, so your listeners may be aware of this. 100 years ago, there was a black man by the name of Jesse Washington, and he was lynched in Waco after being accused of having raped and killed a farm woman. And the trial lasted an hour. The jury was out for 4 minutes. And then after they returned, a mob stormed the courthouse. They grabbed Washington and brought him out to the city square in Waco and did horrible things. They chopped off his fingers. They castrated him. And then they slowly burned him over an open fire. And this was in front of thousands of people. The crowd is estimated to have been as large as 15,000 people, many of whom were cheering. Well, this is awful. 100 years from now, it's inconceivable to us. Only 100 years. So here's what's interesting. Biological evolution takes hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions of years. Cultural evolution is super fast. It's change on steroids. So we can change ourselves. We can change our culture. We can change our norms. And that gives me tremendous hope.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Judy Kay on the line in Dallas. Hi, Judy Kay.
Hi, Chris. Thanks.
Sure.
Hey, listen, keeping with the moral theme, my question is in regard to politicians, defense attorneys, prosecutors, judges that accuse and convict someone, or a doctor that has now does something bad, and they never admit it. And then years later, they go, oh, yeah, I messed up. Well, I don't understand that. You know you're doing wrong, and I don't understand the brain. How come that brain part of the brain hasn't evolved? Not all of them do it, but the majority, when they do it, it's just awful. So that's my question. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's a great observation, and it's true. Look, we know in our own personal lives, nobody likes to admit they were wrong. Politicians don't want to admit they're wrong any more than when you're doing something as a child and you get caught. You want to deny it. And I tell the story in the book of a primate by the name of Lucy, who knew sign language and who gets into an argument with a social scientist by the name of Roger Fouts, who taught sign language to primates. She defecated on the living room floor of the house where she was living. She was raised as a just like a human being child. They even dressed her up in diapers and things like this. And she defecated in the middle of the living room floor. She got into an argument with Roger, and they're conducting this argument through sign language. And Roger says, what's that? And she says, what's what? And she kind of denies that anything has gone wrong. And then he says, you know, what's that? And she immediately blames Sue, who's a graduate student who pops in and out of her environment. And he says, no, that's not Sue. And she says, it's Roger. So now she turns the tables, and she accuses him of having defecated in the living room. Finally, he's getting really mad with sign language. Imagine, they're face-to-face, and they're signing this. He says, no, not me. Who did it? And finally, she tells the truth. She cops a plea, and she says, yes, I did it. Lucy. Sorry. Dirty. Well, wow. What does that tell you about the human brain? We're primates, and our primate ancestors were doing this, so it's not a surprise that we human beings do it as well. We don't want to be caught.
All right, I want to finish with this, Rick. You're a history guy and also a journalist looking at things in the modern era. Has there been a primary season in American history that was this wild and woolly?
Well, we used to have... okay, first let me point out this. We didn't have the primary system really until about a half a century ago, or a little bit more than a half a century ago. So before that, it was the party bosses who mainly did the selecting of the candidates of the two main parties. So we are in somewhat new territory. That's the first observation. The second one is, no, there has been no primary in the last 50 or 60 years since we switched to the primary system, where anything closely remote to what we're going through right now is happening. We are in uncharted waters. What's going to happen tonight in Iowa is going to set the world on its heels. Who knows what's going to come out of it? It could be a President Trump, which honestly I'm personally scared to daylights of.
Do you think this is a factor of the individuals who are running for the nominations in this election, or is this a factor of the times that we live in?
I think it's a problem primarily of two factors. The Great Recession left a deep gash, an open wound in the public perception of politics. That's the first thing. The second thing is the ongoing threat from terrorism. So you put those two things together and people are in an angry, upset, worried, fearful mood. And all it takes is a couple of politicians to come along who are willing to breach the norms of civil behavior, like Donald Trump, and just blatantly appeal to people's instinctive fears and their anger. And you get a primary like we're seeing right now.
All right, we just have about 30 seconds left. How do we get in the habit of questioning our own assumptions so that we know we're making good decisions?
Well, you just have to, I guess, read the book and understand all the different ways in which our brain can trick us. And once you're aware of it, it's just like becoming an educated consumer, which we started to do in the 1960s once our consciousness was raised about the ways that corporations were manipulating us. I'm alerting you to the ways politicians can manipulate your brain. And once you know that, you can then take defensive measures.
Rick Schenkman is publisher and editor of the History News Network and author of the new book, Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Rick, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks for making time for us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Weddington, and we had help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and the show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.